What's up, everybody? Welcome back to a brand new episode of Life After High School, the number one resource podcast in the entire world. I wouldn't say this to you guys if it was not purely factual. Brought to you by me, Glenn YG. I am your host and the man behind the microphone. Each week, we look to drop a new episode, so make sure you guys subscribe on YouTube and wherever you get your podcast from. Don't forget to also follow the podcast on social media at Life After High School 1. We've got a killer episode for you guys this week, so without further ado, let's dive right into it. Cue that intro, baby.
It's the Life After High School podcast.
Thanks. Yeah, appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's going to be fun.
So, Rob, first and foremost, I want to thank you for your time today. I know you're a busy guy. You got a lot of things going on, so I'm grateful you're able to sit down with me today and share your story, spread your message with me, the audience, and I'm excited to learn from you, man. So,
yeah, thank you very much for doing the show. No problem at all. Appreciate being here and appreciate you taking the time to have me on. I was actually looking at your some of your socials there, and I've upcoming people, and I'm like, I see my name, I see another guy's name, and then I'm like, Mr. World Peace, and I'm like, I hope I don't go on after that guy. That's a freaking high bar.
That's a high energy individual, man.
Yeah. So I didn't know who he was, and then Jamie was showing. I guess he came to our house, and then started seeing some of his YouTube stuff.
Oh, I'm no, like, kidding.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
Oh, so, awesome.
Yeah. Hopefully it's before Mr. World.
Yeah, we can work something out. That was a really good conversation, right? I don't want to spend too much time on that, but there's some cool things that will really help me understand a bit more of the subjects we talk about today. Cool. So it's cool to see patterns come about. But what I want to dive into first, to give people a bit of context about you, take us through kind of your like leaving high school transition period time. And then I want to know as well, I want to pair that question with if what you're doing now is what you thought you were doing then, going to do that. Like take us through that time frame.
Yeah. So leaving high school, that was quite some time ago, mid to late 90s. And, probably a lot like most kids back in the 90s, kind of tail end of Generation X, man. It was a little bit of a, you know, kind of like there was the whole grunge era and, you know, what am I going to do with my life? And, you know, the existential crisis of Reality Bites and all that stuff, right? So, high school wasn't probably really the most engaged student. So, got through the grade 12 at the time, got through the grade 13. And then, I think that was the last year where they had it. They might've had it 1 year after that. And then really kind of was looking at like, what am I going to do here? It was the pathway of, you know, can go to try to get into a university and do whatever at the time or try to figure something out. So I actually took a year and a bit off and ended up working at Purolator Courier.
Nice.
At the time, my uncle was the senior vice president of Purolator International.
Sick.
And so I called him up and said, you know, any chance you can get me a job? He says, well, yeah, of course.
Of course I can get
you a job, say right? No more. So I ended up getting through there and started on the graveyard shift emptying transport trailers.
Nice.
Right? So you have a 53-foot trailer full of packages and a conveyor belt, and then two people in that trailer emptying them out for like 6, 7, 8 hours a day. So
you're one of those guys.
That was one of those amazing guys. Yeah. Amazing. So then got into that. I was doing that and it was having a blast, man. Everybody that I worked there with was fantastic. Still to this day, still see people 30 years later and, you know, fist bumping them
because
they're doing their routes or you see them around. Right. So then ended up going to Cambrian College for their firefighter program.
Nice.
Did that. It was the first year they had actually had the practical portion. Before that, there was only the theory piece. But we had to go down to Oshawa to Durham College in Whitby for the second half of the year. So we had, you know, these 20 some kids all from Sudbury that ended up finishing the first part and then all got shipped down as a group down to Durham College in Whitby. So
brutal.
Had a great time down there and, you know, got an apartment and did all of that stuff. Graduated, did really well. And then basically the way the hiring process works for fire departments in Ontario, it's like each one is separate at that time. And if you, you know, you want to work in Sudbury, you apply in Sudbury, work in Toronto, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
Right. So then it was like, well, shit, now what do I do? You know, because done this firefighting course, living in Southern Ontario having a blast with like, 15, 18 of your buddies. And then all of a sudden reality sets in and you got to get a job, right?
Yeah, so, bites us all.
Yeah, so the day after we graduated, a friend of mine, Matty Lawson, ended up getting a job at a company called Expertech, which is a subsidiary of Bell at the time. Basically, Bell lineman work, right?
You're so sick, yeah.
Climbing poles, pulling cable, putting fiber optics in. And that was at the height of the Nortel days. So, you're pulling 10 feet of cable, making 20 grand, 25 grand for the company, right?
You're busy.
So, busy. So he got a job, called me the next day and said, Rob, I got a job here. There's a job here if you want it.
Yeah.
So went in, met with the manager, got hired that day. And then almost exclusively that same group of 18, 20 guys, I'd say 14 of them all got hired at the same company. So we've all just kind of transitioned from college now into Expertech. And then we spent a year, I spent about a year and a half, climbing poles in backyards in Toronto
pulling cable
and putting in telephone poles and in every different area in Toronto, all over the place, right? So did that. And at the time, kept applying to different departments and ended up getting hired here in Sudbury in September of 2000. And then I've been working here ever since. So I'm starting my 25th year here in September.
Nice.
Yeah.
I have a question for you that's always kind of been on my mind, but it doesn't seem like it's at the forefront of things. Do you work at a law firm? I'm curious.
Yeah. So that's a bit further into the story. I do work for a group that does disability law. Down in they're based out of Hamilton, but they do disability law countrywide. Nice. Matt Lalonde is the lead on that. Great guy, and they've taken a position where they're seeing a deficiency in people being able to get secured benefits and LTD and all these things as a result of their benefit providers. So if you have a benefit provider at work, you get hurt, and you're a unionized employee, there's a whole navigation that has to go through collective agreement. And, it's like a four-step process to determine whether or not it can be arbitrated, which is in front of an arbitrator. It has to go to court and so on and so forth. So Matt's a Sudbury boy. Matt's a Sudbury boy. And him and I have known each other for a long time. So their philosophy was, let's put a union focus on this and see what's going on, because disability law issues is something that unions all across Canada are dealing with, and there's not a lot of resources for unions to do it anymore. They used to deal with it internally.
Right.
And it's getting harder and harder for them to do so, right? So
now they can't. They almost source it out to them.
Resource it. That's the plan on expanding it and stuff. And it's good to have somebody with some labor relations experience, right? So you have a carpenter or a firefighter or police officer or whatever, trying to relay the labor side of the issues to the lawyers that specialize in the disability law, because there's all kinds of different facets of law.
Yeah, it's crazy.
To have that kind of intermediary that has an understanding of A and B, because back when I was doing firefighter union stuff, I used to do advocacy work for interest arbitration, collective agreements. I would present cases in front of boards and stuff like that, right? So it's
exciting.
Well, it's something.
It's a lot of hoops.
It's a lot of hoops,
a lot of red tape.
Yeah.
Jeez. Why'd you first get into that stuff? What was the desire to fight the man with that type of stuff?
I don't know.
Or just represent them, I should say. It might be a better way of framing it.
Yeah, it was always just kind of a thing where coming into the fire service and, the perception versus reality thing of labor relations and stuff, and, what you think is happening before you walk in the door and what's actually happening is a lot different, right? So a lot of the same issues that labor groups have with their employer, we would have with our employer. And for the most part, like, don't get me wrong, City of Sudbury is a great employer. There's obviously differences and at times, but
it's going to happen with everything.
Yeah, you know, but for the most part, they're great people. But, you know, sometimes you disagree on stuff, and there's a process, which is, you know, kind of navigating a collective agreement and then going to rights arbitration if there's an interpretation of the collective agreement issue, or interest arbitration if you need a new collective agreement. And because we don't have the ability to strike, we go to what's called binding arbitration, which is in front of a board, and you have, you know, a panel. You used to have a panel, now it's a sole guy, but you have to go argue your case, right? And then it becomes binding. Mm-hmm. So for me, I always enjoyed, like, in high school and getting into, you know, Pure Later, because it was the Teamsters at the time, I always enjoyed the legal side of things, right? Like, we'd have an issue of whether or not you can dye your hair purple at Lockerbie when I went to high school. Well, we're going to fight this and we're going to argue this with the, I look back and it's freaking stupid.
Like, everybody's hair is purple, right? Now,
or at the time, I think it was a nose ring. Somebody had a nose ring and we're arguing whether or not you can have a nose ring. But that was like 35 years ago, 36 years.
You'll never have one, but you'll speak on behalf of those
100%, people. I love it. Right? Well, 100%. But it's also, it's kind of that, amazing. You know, you get, when you get really good at it or into it, it's a game like anything else. Like, it's not a game, but it's a competition like anything else, right? Yeah. So you got to know your facts. You got to be able to debate. You have to be able to think on your feet. You have to have enough confidence in yourself to know that if you're referencing a certain piece of legislation, or you're referencing a certain clause or case law or what have you, that you don't have to have it memorized, but you better know
where to find it.
Say it, it better be there, because that's your reputation, right?
Right.
So I became pretty good at that, and started kind of, you know, making a name for myself at the provincial firefighters level. And at the time, there was a whole issue going on with the Liberal government and the teachers with Bill 115. They were basically trying to beat down the teachers, and they were violating their rights, their charter rights. There wasn't a question about it. But because politics and labor intersect, and politicians and labor leaders intersect, there's sometimes where people may not want to say something for fear of causing an issue somewhere else with a politician, right? And at the time, there was all kinds of labor groups speaking up, in support of the teachers, and we were, I wouldn't say we weren't, but we weren't necessarily.
Couldn't voice it
quite as much. That's so frustrating. Yeah, so me being, you know, probably 5 minutes on the block, right? You know, and then having, I have a mentor of mine, great guy, his name's Henry Watson. He was a 35-year firefighter in Hamilton. For 30 of those years, he was the local president in Hamilton.
He's seen some things.
Hamilton, Sudbury, Windsor are all, those are very similar places, very similar personalities, you know.
Amazing.
Hardcore steel town, nickel town, you know, auto town. They're built different, right? 100%. So, you know, he would have a position that might be different than someone else in the GTA for the most part. And basically we got to this seminar where somebody was going to have this discussion on whether or not we were supporting the teachers, and just got to the microphone. And at the time, you know, our MPP was Rick Bartolucci. He's an amazing guy. He's great guy, but we saw things. We didn't see things eye to eye on this, right? So we were talking at the time, and, you know, basically went to the microphone and proceeded to, you know, give this like 10-minute diatribe on how this is, the Liberal government is violating the constitutional rights of these teachers. And then it was like, well, who is this kid?
It's your episode.
Who is this kid to come in and start basically talking, you know? So half of it was like, who's this guy? The other half of it was like, who's this guy?
You always have to, like, build up a credibility in the moment.
A little bit. Yeah. So from there, it became more of an opportunity to, you know, voice concerns for the members here locally, voice concerns for members here provincially. Mm-hmm. And that's when I got into working for the IFF as an advocate. The IFF is the International Association of Firefighters. So right. working for them as an advocate, which is presenting cases in arbitration hearings for
right.
for collective agreements. And the way firefighters do it, they're unique, is the employers will hire a lawyer to present their case. The firefighters will hire a trained firefighter to Sick. Present their case, because the process is, the thought process is, nobody knows firefighter issues better than firefighters.
Makes sense, yeah.
So let's teach them to be quasi-lawyers as opposed to teaching a lawyer
yeah.
to be a firefighter.
So you put that hat on.
Exactly, yeah, right? Okay. So started doing that and worked on cases, you know, in different locals in Ontario, and you know, we were successful in there. And then decided to go the political route, and our provincial organization is called the Ontario Professional Firefighters Association.
Right.
And ran for what would be their number two job, which at the time was called an executive vice president.
Mm-hmm.
Ran against a seasoned individual out of Toronto. Toronto has 3,000 members, right? So they're the largest in Canada.
Yeah.
Hands down, they're 30%-ish. Of the entire population of firefighters in Toronto or in Ontario.
Yeah.
So, right. you know, the chances of being successful were like, it wasn't about that. It was about getting out, making a statement and, you know, pushing I don't want to say the agenda, but just making it identified that, hey, there's a whole new other generation of leaders coming up.
Shift the narrative a little bit.
Right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because a lot of the guys have been there for a long time, right? Some of our leaders at the IFF, at the international level, have been retired for 20, 25 years, 30 years or whatever.
Things have changed,
sure. right? Not to discredit anything they've done, but firefighting and from when I started to now is completely different.
Man, we were just talking about that with like men from 40 years ago to now. Like everything changes, right? Everything changes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So ran that election, lost that election, and it was fine. We just came back and kept doing the same thing I was doing. And 2 years later, decided to go again, but at this time there was no opponent. So basically it was looking like I was going to get acclaimed, right? Because we had another guy that was the president out of Oakville, great guy. And right on the eve of all of this stuff, the organization ended up getting involved in a legal matter in relating to WSIB claims and fraud, where firefighters that were passing away from cancer were alleging to be defrauded by people that were essentially working for the organization.
Come on.
So there was a lot of tension, a lot of things going on.
Yeah.
And I get a phone call. I still remember it to this day. I was sitting down on Van Horn Station, and I get a phone call from the president who said, I'm not going to run again in 2016. And I said, oh, that's too bad, because he had some health issues and some stuff that he had to take care of, and, you know, some serious things. And you got to take care of yourself first, man. This 100%. Job, I mean, both jobs, firefighting and the union business, it is a big stressor on you, right? So I said, oh shit, who's taking your place?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you are. I said, hold on a second.
Yeah, hold the phone.
You know, at the time, I think I was, you know, early 30s, whatever it was, 36 or what, you know, whatever, however old I was young, and I'm from Sudbury, right? So we have Toronto with 3,000, Ottawa with 1,000, Mississauga with 700, Brampton with 500, you know, Hamilton, all these huge departments, right, with big locals.
Yeah.
And I said, what are you fucking talking about, man? Like, that's what he's like, no, you're gonna be great. And I said, okay, well, let me process this. 2 minutes later, the International Association of Firefighters rep for Ontario and Manitoba calls and says, you got to do this. This is, you got to do this. And I said, I don't, I don't, this is a jump, man. This is a big jump.
Yeah, steep.
And he's like, you got it. It's not a big deal. It's not like down, trying to downplay, yeah. trying to sell, right? Trying yeah. to downplay.
Yeah, trying to sell you the position for sure.
Yeah. And at the time, I had two brand new kids. My youngest might have been maybe 2 or 3 years old, and my oldest might have been 6.
It never happens when you're not that busy, eh?
Exactly, right? Yeah. So he says, oh, you know, you might be away from home a couple times a week, and, you know, that's about it, right? So at the time, talked about it with, you know, what now my ex-wife, talked about it with my wife. And so, yeah. You know, at the time, we're just like, well, might as well at least give it a shot, right? So ended up becoming, I think it was like the first person in 42 years to ever go from like just a local president to the provincial president. And the provincial president in Canada
Epic,
runs yeah. the largest firefighter union in Canada. Sorry, the Ontario is the largest firefighter
Makes
union
sense, yeah.
in Canada.
Yeah.
It's bigger than every other province.
BC, combined. Yeah.
Quebec. Everyone, that's crazy. Right? And then it's the 6th largest in North America. So you're...
Come on.
Yeah, you're right up there with, like, you know, California, Ohio, all these New different York, places. Imagine, yeah, yeah, New York State and everything else.
What?
So, yeah, roll into that in the summer of 2016 and basically had a pretty wild ride with managing, you know, the fraud case and managing the criminal side of that. We push forward issues on certification and professionalism through NFPA, with NFPA through the Ministry of Correctional Services, mm-hmm. Community Service Correctional Services, pushed through legislative change for the first time in 25 years in the Ambulance Act, allowing a program for firefighters that are paramedics to be able to provide services on the back of a fire truck. That alone was...
That's huge.
It was huge, wow. And it was huge opposition to that.
So, really?
Oh, yeah. So if you ever want to Google my name and send paramedics...
Send paramedics
was like an internet lobby group that was diametrically opposed to what we were trying to do, right? So, yeah, it was a big thing. Like, I did debates on global news about this yeah. and the whole nine yards, right? So it was a trip. And then it got to the point where it just became too much and stepped down and decided not to run again in 2020. So came out in 2020 and then I've been back here since. So, but then got Gosh. Into a whole other realm of
yeah.
of government lobbying and stuff like that. So...
Epic, man. So what I'm curious about, doesn't stop, eh? Man, there's the big thing I'm curious about, Rob, when it comes to that stuff that I've having researched, done my due diligence, talking to people, and about you and reading through kind of what you've done and done like my bit of research here and there, and just hearing from what you've had to say just now, there seems to be, whenever big things happen and each group of people needs a spokesperson, right? Yeah. And they have those representatives and stuff like that to bring to whatever tables or levels of government you need to get, you know, action taken. My question for you is, is there a strategy that's used? Like, how do you go about navigating so that it seems like there's the victims, the council, and then the people responding? Like, everybody gets heard instead of just everybody looking to point a finger. How do you navigate that? Like, so you're not just like on one side or picking sides. It's like, hey, I'm representing this group and I'm not agreeing with the victims. I'm not disagreeing with them. I'm not against this or for that. And you can correct me if I'm wrong here and stating whether you're wrong or not, but how do you go about navigating that? Like, is it a strategy? Is it like on the whim? Is it like everything you've seen? Like, has it been seen before?
It's pretty fluid based on the file, right? So based on the file. So for example, one of the issues was the paramedic on a fire truck thing, right? Mm-hmm. Had to evolve that from a previous strategy. And we looked at it from like a delivery perspective, what's good for the public, financial, and then did a light test against what the status quo was, right? And
right.
And and paramedicine and pre-hospital care in Ontario, it's audited by the Auditor General. So you have an opportunity to see what the effectiveness is based on the costs, right? So you're able to utilize those things and pick a strategy to navigate that to make financial sense.
So you do have the cost versus analysis.
So we actually did a forecast, financial forecast model with like PricewaterhouseCoopers so that you could actually, each municipality could punch in their numbers and they could make a determination on whether or not it was cost effective or not.
Right.
Because what cost effective in Sudbury is not cost effective in Toronto.
Very different.
So you have to look at it case by case. Makes sense, then you also have single tier municipalities versus upper tier municipalities, which is whether or not you have a region, right? And without amalgamation in Ontario, we had Ottawa, Sudbury, Hamilton that were single tier municipalities.
Right.
Responsible for their own delivery, and then the province would pay this stuff.
I see. Okay.
In Vaughan, when you have York region, or in Oshawa, and you have Durham region, then you have an extra layer of bureaucracy and things that you have to go through.
Right.
And there's no type of empire building like emergency service empire building, right? Like each silo has its own gig, and there's only so much money in the pie, and you have to navigate that. And then it became an issue of like, what makes sense, right? So if I have a paramedic that's qualified sitting on the back of my fire truck as a firefighter, and we arrive first on the scene, that individual is not allowed to perform their skill sets that they've been trained to based on the legislation.
Despite having all the requirement, like all the equipment required
with
you guys. Right.
So you have a situation where you have like one of our firefighters, and we have lots of guys that have done the paramedic training, but one in particular was a critical flight medic, critical care flight medic.
Oh, so it's
on ART.
Yeah.
On the air ambulance.
Yeah.
So
they're
He can do basically anything on the ambulance.
Yeah, he's doing surgery.
But then when he comes onto the fire truck, he's very limited, right? So then,
and not lack of equipment.
Well, there's for the most part, like
what
for
he's
the,
allowed to do.
It's not so much the equipment as it would be the meds, right? Because we're not allowed to carry meds and stuff like that. Yeah,
interesting.
Okay. Yeah, so makes sense. It's all starting to evolve now, and one of the big things that I think is opening up some, I think I personally believe we were too early, right? Yeah. So when we did this, it was just before the election in 2018, when Kathleen Wynne lost and Premier Ford came on, and it was just too soon, right?
Right.
And I think COVID and fentanyl, the opioid crisis, I think are having people look at that, because during COVID down in Toronto, you had people waiting for 2 hours on the side of the road waiting for a transport unit to get them to the hospital. But the fire crew's sitting there and you can't just
leave them do anything
because it's patient abandonment, right? So you have this situation where we lobbied to allow them to use the skill set. We lobbied for what we call treat and release, which is basically you cut your arm, I'm going to put a band-aid on you. I don't need to transport you to the hospital. You're good to go. Right. Or treat and refer. Look at you. Okay, there's a clinic over there. You can go over there.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So all these things pass legislation.
There are solutions. Then.
Yeah, okay. And the paramedics have been using them very successfully lately. But nobody has taken on the EMCA certified firefighter paramedic pilot project yet.
Right.
Because at the time, in the emergency service world, it was like chaos, right? Like fire chiefs arguing unions and paramedics arguing firefighters and unions arguing unions. And it was a lot because it was, everybody thinks it's going to be a big shift over to, you know, this fire is going to take over. It's impossible.
Yeah.
Like it's not
too much change.
Too much change, you know, and the fire service is 200 years of tradition, never repeated by progress. You know what I mean?
Right.
So. Yeah. But you know, now we're in a situation where 2017, when we had Narcan put on the truck, so we lobbied the government and with our partners and the other stakeholder groups in fire to have Narcan put on the truck.
Amazing,
before 2017, we had no Narcan. And we'd go to fentanyl calls.
And you just sit there and be like, you can't do anything.
You basically give oxygen, do your vitals, right. But there's nothing you can do, right?
Just like preliminary assessment.
Yeah, but for the most part, right? So you're, it's kind of silly, right?
Yeah.
So now, you know, it'll start to evolve because I think for the most part, the public is going to demand even more like service for dollars. Right. And if you're there already anyway, and you have the ability to make a difference, you know,
yeah, why not?
What's wrong with an EpiPen or what's wrong?
Yeah. What's stopped?
You know, so these are the things that, the groups have to wrestle with.
Yeah.
Where you go to, down to South Texas, the guy can do a tracheotomy on the side of the road.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not joking, but at the time it was fun and it worked out well. It was the first time it ever been, the act had ever been changed in 25 years and it was us that did it. So, you know, we made some, we had some opponents, but like, whatever for us, it was like, check, you know,
you can't make everybody happy when it comes to doing stuff you're doing.
No,
nobody likes change, especially in this region.
Yeah.
We'll call it, or especially with stuff like services that have such hardcore deep traditions, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's, you know, I think everybody on that particular file, it was like a personal reaction. Right, like
which is emotional, hard, personal
reaction, and it's like, no, we're not. Nobody's trying to take anybody's jobs here, guys.
Yeah,
just trying to help out the system. You know what I mean?
Which is kind of leads to my next thing I'm wondering about, especially when it comes to, because it's funny you mentioned the meme thing. In researching, there's certain things I'm like, I don't care about certain things, but there's some things that I'm like, I want to like really understand maybe potentially where both sides are coming from.
Yeah.
Well, both sides, there's like four sides in half the things, right? So not just A or B, it's like A to Z. So I'm looking at it and I see like as many hate towards you and what the action is, and then as much for, but then I'm trying to understand the other side and I'm like, you know, obviously there's a bit of bias, right? Because you're a friend of mine, but yeah, I don't want to like look at, I'm like, why do you, this doesn't seem like, why is there a Facebook group dedicated against this? Like, what is he? I was like, I don't think it's that, like somebody spent so much time. But I was listening to something a while ago, and this person, this woman, she mentioned how deciding in terms of political opinions and politicians and council and stuff like that, is we make our decisions a lot of the time based on emotions,
100%.
Based on feelings. And it's like, regardless, most politicians are, you know, at a high level of politicians, maybe not like our MPs and stuff like that, but they're more often not narcissists, right? Like they have those tendencies. At the bare minimum, I'd say like a lot of them have tendencies. Now, you can agree or disagree with that, but that's kind of what I've seen and hearing her point, and then going, huh. You know, everybody seems to make these emotional decisions and that seems to fight it. And like almost it fights against them more than it does for them.
Yeah, right? I don't know about the narcissism side of things, but I do know that their business is their brand, right? Politicians, their business is their brand. So they have to maintain a certain brand to be able to be successful in their business.
I like that way.
You know what I mean? So it's not because, you know, with the narcissist side of things, it's like that would be absence of caring about anybody but themselves. And I've worked with lots of politicians that are passionate, like Jamie West, you've had him on the show. I saw that, like, great guy. Frangel, our MPP from Nickel Belt. If there was one person I would ever go to war with, it would be France. She is amazing. And it's her. It's not about her. It's about, you know, we had an issue here in Sudbury with a triple fatality and then a coroner's inquest that we ended up being able to get done 5 years after the fact.
Mm.
Had it not been for Fraz, the people affected, the people that passed away and the community as a whole wouldn't have had a voice, right? Mm. Like, so it's one of those things where, but it's but to your point on the emotion is what sells everything, right? When I put forward the financial side of things, nobody cared.
No.
Because the Ministry of Health Long-Term Care in the province of Ontario's budget is larger at the time, is larger than every other department's budget in the province of Ontario combined.
Crazy.
You know, like like billions and billions and billions of dollars. So if I say I'm going to save you 100 grand. Well, what's 100 grand? It's a rounding error.
Yeah.
In that, but if I say I'm going to save this person,
yeah,
by allowing my firefighter on the back of the truck to be able to perform to their full skill set that they've been trained on, that's going to save somebody's life.
100%.
Right? Then it's like, oh, that's what makes sense. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Interesting.
Yeah. So
it's easier to connect with people when they show that side of emotion, especially when it's used passionate. And I want to just circle back and mention quickly before I jump forward about the, her example was Trump and Biden.
Okay.
So that's why the narcissism was like, yeah. You know, like both sides in that case. Yeah, yeah, in right, that right. case. But yeah, so going back to this, he, looking at how people can connect to passion and people connect to, like, I think, was it you? You've said this to me in the past, and I know other people have, but it was a while ago. It was like, you're the truth, right? Like, yeah. You're like truth coming forward and stuff like that. So understanding that when it's, I think where there's a disconnect is when people use their emotions to manipulate, right? And make other people feel a certain way, or like, hey, I want you to feel bad because I feel bad about this. It's like, now I'm playing victim, I'm playing sad, and everybody now needs to relate to me and understand what I'm going through. And if you don't agree with me, you're the problem, you're the villain.
Well, sure, that's cognitive behavior yeah. therapy, right? That's what they right. teach you, is like, yeah. your emotions are not my problem.
Right.
Your reaction or your feelings are not. I cannot make you feel right. a certain way.
It's crazy.
You may think I can, but the reality is I can't.
100%. Right?
So yeah. how you interpret and process what I say to you is on you, not on me.
Absolutely.
And that's what this whole, like, yeah. you know, this notion of feelings and perception is reality. No, mm-hmm. that's craziness. Feelings yeah. are fleeting.
Yeah. Feelings are aren't reality. Yeah.
That's right. Right. So, but in turn, like, what's making it so much harder for people is like this constant, because the other half of this equation in terms of these strategic campaigns and how we were so successful is we launched like strategic micro-targeting campaigns
yeah.
a la Victory Lab, Sasha Eisenberg, Obama 2000, yeah. you know, campaign and stuff, utilizing social media and stuff. And nobody else in labor in this country was, like, we use the platform called Nation Builder, and there's mm-hmm. other ones, but those are campaign platforms,
right?
Right. That's how you run a political campaign. We said mm-hmm. we're going to take the strategy of a political campaign and put it into an issue.
Right.
So myself and another individual went down to a campaign tech conference in Washington, D.C.
Epic, yeah.
Only two union people in the room. Everybody else is running, you know, gubernatorial campaigns, presidential campaigns, congressional campaigns. And then there's these two union thugs in the room, like, what are you guys doing here?
Yeah.
But we're trying to learn, right? We're trying to see how you guys are doing this. And we took that process and we took those tools and those skill sets and put them into, let a firefighter paramedic on the back of the truck do their job. Put into their, firefighters should be certified under the National Fire Protection Association's yeah. qualifications. So we took that and then we utilized tools like New Mode. So like, provincial politicians were mm-hmm. getting direct direct phone calls, direct emails from the public, right? And it's one of these things, sick. Like, yeah. if you look at 2 days ago, yesterday, whatever mm-hmm. it was, Pierre Polyev's op-ed in the National Post, he yeah. said, fire your lobbyists, go to the public, right? 100%. And I'm not blue or red or red, orange,
green, yellow, orange.
You know, my mentor, Henry Watson, used to say, I'm a political whore. I'll work with whoever to get yeah. what I need to get done for 100%. The person on the back step yeah. of the fire truck, right? So you work with all parties to try to get done. Then, you know, we were yeah. successful
in
doing that, right? I think it's gone to the point where it's it's almost in hyperdrive, where people are seeing this stuff and taking it for news or taking it for... that's fact, and that's right. what's skewing a so lot of these.
If you're
things.
Not one, you must be the other.
Yeah, which is yeah, insane, crazy. Right? This is the problem with the political discourse in this in the West as a whole, is like, if yep. you don't agree with everything on the left, you must be yeah. right.
And well, you must be far one or the other.
Well, we don't have middle anymore. We don't even have degrees anymore. It's far left, far right.
We lost that.
We've lost that, right? And it's one of the, like, that's, and I think, excuse me, I think that's where the anger is coming in. And I think that's where the disengagement is coming in. Because a lot of people don't want to be called a Nazi because they don't agree with, you know, whatever issue is happening on either side, right? You can be anti this, but pro this. Right. For whatever reason. Yeah. Right. Like if it's, you know, without getting into the politics of it. But, you know, I have two daughters. There's things on the left that I don't agree with.
Right.
But there's things on the right I don't agree with. Right. So I'm a centrist. Right? We used to have those politicians that would be Dalton McGuinty was a great centrist for the most part. Not always, but he was a great centrist for the most part. You don't see that anymore. It's far left, far right. Right. So.
Man, it's freaking crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy to see how everything shifted and how people are in. And I do think it's derived from the making too many emotional decisions that create the divide.
Oh, 100%.
We're doing, right?
It's 100%.
It's clear as day. And the tough thing that I look at, and I look at what the good and the bad is, and both, and then there's things I understand, because it's like, if you don't like, well, certain people I love and care about, might agree with this, but then other people might not agree with that. It's like, I'm like, just because I want to own a gun doesn't mean I, you know, I disagree with everything somebody else says. It's like, no, you can see kind of every side to it. And I think, is it eccentric? Like, like you're in the middle of it. You're trying to find where that middle is. But depending on who you talk to, that middle might, it's like, well, no, you sound like you're more one way than the other. Well, let's try to find a way to navigate it a bit better. But the thing I'm curious about and the way I'd like to look at it is if we shift gears a bit and focus on kind of the mental health side of it and what you guys see and going through all this, I'm curious to know, before I forget about this question, is what's your favorite and then what is your least favorite shift you've ever had? That'll stepping stone to the next thing I want to
ask you about. Like in terms of events or in terms of, so.
Yeah. It can be however you want to.
Yeah. It's, well, they're all based on, you know, high stress environments, but I'd say the most memorable positive shift that I have, the one that sticks out the most.
Right. Nice.
We had an apartment fire here in the downtown core, and somebody had thrown a Molotov cocktail in the front entrance of the building and caught the place on fire, and there was people trapped, and we had one individual who on the third floor was trapped in his apartment, developmentally challenged individual, and we were able to basically, you know, at the time we were limited, what we have now on our engines, which is our pumper truck, we have four firefighters. On our ladder aerial truck, we have four firefighters. But at the time, back then, we had four on our pumper engine, and then we had one on our ladders. So we're trying to effect a rescue with, at the time, and that initial, you know, kind of like 6-7 minutes with five people. Right, with a fully involved structure fire, with people hanging out the window.
Come on,
right?
So five people,
two trucks, right? So we were able, between the two trucks, we were able to get a ladder up, get up, and I'll never forget it. We had our captain, who has his own responsibilities, trying to figure this out. With two of our guys going in to put water on the fire, because the safest way to protect people is to put the fire out.
Makes sense, yeah.
But then we have this guy hanging out the window.
Come on.
And if he falls, he's gonna die.
Yeah, three stories up, right?
Yeah, he's gonna die. And he's, you know, it's basically like a chimney and it's coming out the window, so he's getting burnt and everything else. So myself and the captain were able to put the ladder up, and then the captain had to go and do his thing. And I'll never forget it, one of the police officers said, "I got it." And he's getting pumped with smoke. He said, "I got it." Climbed up, basically, you know, I climbed up to the window. The guy's like, "I got my dog in here." I said, "I'll get your dog in a second." So, grabbed him. He didn't want to come. Ended up getting him on the ladder, pulling him out, saving his life.
Amazing.
So that was great. You know?
Yeah, awesome.
There's a couple calls that are, you know, the highlight reels on the other side.
Yeah, you can go right? So happy.
Yeah, and when you deal with issues with occupational stress injuries and stuff, those are the ones that never go away.
Right.
They never, like, they're in your head for life. Mm-hmm. Right. And three that stick out the most for me. One was a fentanyl overdose. Mm-hmm. She had come into town. She'd been living in a boarding house and she basically had her vision board and you could see the progression from, you know, small town girl. And then her pictures started to slowly degrade because of the drugs. And, you know, so we get on scene, she's unresponsive. Got my guys are working, you know, and I'm looking for her health card. I'm looking, guys, because at the time I was a captain, looking for a health mm-hmm. card, looking for, and I was able to witness that degradation of her quality of life in real time on her wall. Right. And for a father of two girls, it's extra. It's extra.
It's a bit different.
You know, another time we had a young a young man decide that he was going to end his life over a result of a breakup with his girlfriend and ended up hanging himself and having to deal with you know, his family there like for quite some time. It's not good. And then my last one that was Christmas, was it Christmas Eve or Christmas Day? Baby died. You know, and then my two girls are at home, right? And it's kind of one of those things where, you know, then you go back to the fire hall and you're making your Christmas dinner or whatever, and you're just sitting there and everybody's just sitting there numb because it's, you know, guys and girls have kids at home, right? And it's like kind of, those are the ones that, you know, they don't leave you, right? They don't ever leave you. Now, with the opioid crisis in this country and Sudbury having per capita year over year some of the highest rates of overdoses, it's a constant thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and as young as 13, 15, 17 years old, right? So it's that constant cumulative exposure to trauma over and over and over again that police, fire, EMS, corrections are seeing, nursing are seeing on a daily basis. You know, so it's tough. Where my father was a firefighter. He retired in 2008 with 34 and a half years. Back in their time, it was smoke. There was no smoke alarms and there was no seatbelts.
Right.
So car accidents, house fires.
All the time.
A lot of fatalities, but not like it's today. Like the men and women of these services are seeing things that people haven't seen ever because of what's happening with fentanyl and opioids and stuff like that. Right. So it's a tough go.
I have a question before I want to jump to something about that. Is there one solution? Or is it, it seems much more complex, but we've talked about this at your place in the past, and I'm curious what you can say about it, but if there's a, like, one solution, end all be all, like, what's going.
Like, I try to think about it from all sides, and it's very, you know, to try to not put the bias into the paramedics and firefighters and police that are seeing this on a daily basis. I don't know what the definition of safe supply is. Like, I don't really understand that because it's still a hard drug, but I'm not a mental health clinician.
Right.
I'm not a healthcare professional in that sense. But for me as a lay person, I don't understand that. Right. On the flip side, from a legal perspective and a criminality perspective, don't really understand that either.
Right.
Because it's like, what, we're going to lock these people up? I don't really understand that part.
Yeah, they didn't really do anything.
Right? Because it's not, what are you going to do? It's tough.
Yeah.
Like, it's tough. Like, what, you know, if we look at our own microcosm, we've had situations where a guy or girl back in the early 2000s hurts your shoulder.
Right.
Break your leg, do whatever. At the time, you get OxyContin.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Downhill, downward spiral as a result. It's not their fault. It's that was a productive tax-paying member of society that, you know, you watch Dope Sick or anything else. You see what happens with that, right? Yeah, and it's 100%. Like, that person doesn't belong in prison.
Freaky.
Right? So it's freaky. Like, you know, and I look at it, I think about it, and it's my own, you know, this is my own opinion. It's like, until the unfortunate thing, and it's like, and I think I said this to you guys before, like, the train has left the station.
Yeah.
On this issue.
Yeah.
Right? You're not putting the genie back in the bottle on this issue. So until somebody comes up with something that can be taken, that's, you know, cheaper, just as effective from a, I guess, a medical high perspective, right, and safer, like, that's the only thing that's going to change it. Yeah. And it's like, does society want to get into the drug production business to manage this? Because I really don't see any other recourse for this. Like,
no.
Decriminalization, obviously the government of British Columbia said that doesn't work.
Doesn't work. To the matter that they're going back on it.
They're going back on it.
Which is crazy. Right? It's like, hey, we admitted we made a mistake.
Yeah.
Which rarely happens. Yeah.
And a good friend of mine's a fire captain in downtown Vancouver that covers East Hastings.
So he sees a couple things.
A couple things.
Overdoses.
And it's like, how do you, and it's not slowing down. Right, and this has been happening. Like, we first saw fentanyl in, God, it's got to be 14, 15 years ago now, where people were stealing patches off palliative care or long term care patients in old age homes, cutting them into strips and smoking them in pens.
Insane, yeah.
And then it's like, done. You know, I had one where it, driving down the road, hit his pen, dead.
Right? Stop.
Yeah. And it's like, how do you manage that? How do you manage that now that it's been in the ecosystem for coming on 15, 20 years now?
In 2020, I did a road trip out west, visit some family in Vancouver, Victoria, right? With like four friends, all hopped in a Toyota Sienna and made our way that way. Now, I had listened to an episode, and I've actually had him on the podcast in like the beginning days, this guy named Garth Mullins, who runs a podcast called Crackdown.
Okay.
He lives on East Hastings Street.
Oh my God.
Oh yeah. It's insane. Yeah. He shows me his like opium and stuff on the show, like over a Zoom call. It was crazy. So he's showing me his kit and stuff. And anyways, we're listening to the show as we get closer, like, you know, from Banff to Vancouver. And we're listening to it, long drive, go through the whole series at that point. And I was like, guys, we got to go down. And I have a video somewhere. And I remember going to downtown, like East Hastings, and going through the street, driving, obviously, like doors locked, whatever. Going down, and then me being me, wanting to get out and walk and just like really get as much of the experience out of it as I can.
Right.
Without participating, right? Now, the biggest thing that I think shocked myself, and I also know shocked the other four guys in the car with me, were the volume, to your point, the volume of it. And for you to say it's not slowing down, that was 4 years ago.
I know.
Man, that's crazy.
It's crazy.
Because it was the sheer volume. I was like, man, the whole entire, what is that, like 1,500 meter long street?
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah, mile long. That.
Yeah.
And everybody, shoulder to shoulder. Man, you'd think it was Mardi Gras.
Yeah.
Like, it was just like, where's the festival happening? It's like, no, there isn't.
No, and it's every day.
Dude, it's so bad.
You know, police, fire, EMS out there every single day. Just
busy.
So the cumulative exposure to that for first responders in that city, in that small area, concentrated area. How long does it take for somebody to crack? 5 years, 2 years, 10 years, you know, and that's just that issue. They're still dealing with car accidents. They're still dealing with house fires. They're still dealing with everything else that they're dealing with. The right. police are still dealing with domestics. They're still dealing with, you know, yeah. violent crimes, everything else. Like,
everything shot.
Yeah. And it's like, how do you manage that and then go home and decompress
right away
to revive yourself to go back the next shift? It's one of these things where it's, you're basically, you know, your nails are on the edge of a cliff right now. Right. So when we yeah. see what's happening in our province with workers' compensation claims for occupational stress injuries and post-traumatic stress disorder, and disorder is a bit of a misnomer. It's right. it's an injury. This is, for the most part, this is an injury. It's not yeah. a disorder. This is what's happened to this individual as a result
right.
of performing their duties.
They were right? born with.
Yeah. Which right. is why we were successful in, along with our stakeholders and police and EMS and corrections back in 16 and 2016, and having the government recognize PTSD as an occupational illness. Right. So
it's huge.
Yeah, we have cancers in our job, and heart diseases in our job that the government and WSIB just, it's presumed to be as a result of your job,
right. right?
Colorectal cancer, brain cancer, lung cancer, all these different cancers, and now post-traumatic stress.
That's crazy.
You know, and yeah. and the claims, if you look at the claims that as a result, they're not slowing down.
Oh, God, no.
You know, yeah. and it's, there's, this is the problem, is that there's a, there's at some point going to be a tipping point, because employers, cities have to pay those premiums or have to pay those claims and everything else. And it's not slowing down. You know, I think last yeah. year, whatever it was, City of Toronto had to add, I think it was like $45 or $50 million extra to their budget just to manage that claim, just for the City of Toronto.
Wow.
Right. So you, you factor yeah. that into 442 municipalities in the province of Ontario.
Yeah, Ontario.
What are those numbers? Right.
So it's extreme.
It's extreme.
Man, I would, if you went and you ran for mayor, I'd vote for you.
You would, would you?
Yeah, man. Yeah. It's been a minute since I voted mayor, but I'd vote local. I'd
the,
vote you. I'd write you in if you didn't.
Yeah. I'm a firm believer that municipal politics is the hardest of all levels.
Really?
Yeah, because you're dealing with things that people see on a day-to-day basis.
Right, which never ending.
Never ending, right? And kudos to every city councilor and mayor that decides to put their name forward, because I can't imagine the level of commitment and what they have to do to be able to manage that effectively. And, mm-hmm. you know, and each city is different. I've had the pleasure of, through my old job at, as the OPFFA president, working with municipal leaders all over Ontario. And right. there's some really good people, and things are not getting easier to manage, right? Mm-hmm. Municipal budgets are not getting easier to manage. And,
no.
And they're getting pulled in 100 different directions, where provincial, you get a file, you're a parliamentary assistant, or you're, you know, you're an assistant to the minister, and your files are like, the file itself is big, but you don't have 100 different files. You don't need to be a right. jack of all trades on everything. And then federally, kind of, you know, again, yeah. you've got more insulation, more bureaucrats to kind of manage it. But municipal politics is, you are boots on the ground, man. Boots on the ground
right on.
For very little yeah. for very little compensation, you know, comparative to the amount of work that they have to do.
Fair enough. Yeah, so not any point so, soon. No. All right. Damn it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fair enough. All right. That answers that. So what I'm curious about, man, looking back kind of on what we were just talking about before, my whole like pitching you doing marriage. You just telling me why you're not gonna do it. Fair. Don't blame you. Still write you. That's a me thing, not a you thing. I'll worry about that later. So what I'm curious about now is, how do you, in regards to the subject of mental health, how do you go about both personally dealing with your own and managing your own? Because like you said, like minutes ago, like deal with you first, number one first, right? 100%. Because right. then like, you know, family, girlfriend, wife, kids, like everybody, you know, they see you on or off shift. So you need to be like there. So I'm wondering, what do you do to take care of yourself personally? And then after, what is there any systems or strategies or things that are implemented for the first responders?
Yeah, so me personally, I did a lot of things wrong leading up to starting to do things
Yeah.
right. When I was 25-ish, had a bad scenario at work, with a PTSD issue.
Right.
And at the time, there wasn't the conversation that there is about it today, right? So went and saw a doctor, and the doctor's response was, go take a vacation, and if you still feel the same way when you get back, come and see me. So I ended up going to Australia for a couple months and left work and did all these, and this is before marriage, before kids,
Yeah, you're saying
before
like
all those
early
things,
20s.
right? So I did that and landed in Sydney, Australia. Made some friends from Ireland, England, bought a van, drove the coast, surfed every
Hell
day,
yeah, of course.
and got to the Great Barrier Reef and came
Sick.
back
Yeah.
and had an amazing adventure and came home and figured, oh, freaking good to go now, right? Feel great. Nothing was fixed. And then kept going, went back to work and kept going to calls, kept going to calls, kept, and then it just slowly starts closing in. And then got into the union world, which was another escape because, at the height of my job, I was gone 220 days a year out of 365, right? I'd be all
Jeez.
over North America. I've been from Alaska
Yeah.
to Florida and everywhere in between. There's
Sick.
nowhere I haven't been. But then the stresses of home and kids and everything else and calls and fraud cases and all of these
Yeah,
things
overwhelming.
got to the point where it became too much, and all of these maladaptive behaviors, mechanisms and everything
Yeah.
else, whether it's this or whether it's like overworking or trying to manage the hypervigilance, and just got to a point where it just became too much. And that was one of the reasons why my marriage at the time ended,
Right.
right? Because my wife at the time said, I
Yeah.
can't deal anymore. Can't
Too much.
too much, which, at the time it's like, the
Understand.
fuck you talking about?
Yeah.
Now it's like, you
Oh.
got to protect yourself first,
Makes
right?
sense. Yeah, it makes a bit more sense.
And then it just went off a cliff, right? And got to a point where, you guys hang out with you guys, go to the gym, do cold plunges, sauna stuff.
Yeah.
I went from walking around at 220, whatever the weight was, my normal weight, I was down to like 163
Come
pounds.
on.
Done,
Bro, did you
done.
shop like 60
60
pounds?
pounds, right? And at the time, trying, because of this whole notion of politicians are selling their brand, myself being a politician in that world, trying to sell that brand, it's like, oh, doing keto and running marathons and doing all these things. In reality,
Yeah.
it's all stress related, to the point where people that I'll never forget for my entire life, people, friends and
Yeah.
colleagues from all over Ontario, showed up at my door in the middle of nowhere, Mark's day, and said, you need to get help, right? You
Really?
need to get help.
That's crazy.
And friends and leaders in the IFF calling and saying, we got to send you down to this treatment center, Rob. You got to go. You're not gonna survive. Like, you got to do something. And
Wow.
like
That's
Fred
huge.
LeBlanc and Ed Kelly are like two people that stand out at the IFF, and all of my colleagues at the OPFFA. And then it was like, you got to do this because you have two little girls that rely on you now,
Holy
right? So
shit,
I ended
yeah.
up getting on a plane in October 20th of 2018 and getting flown down to Maryland to the IFF Center of Excellence Treatment Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder.
Wow.
So I spent a month there, and it was great. Like, the doctors there and the clinicians there were great. And you know, it saved me to the point of being able to get a foothold before falling off the cliff, right? And then working with my own doctor here locally, not locally, she's in Barrie, Dr. Lori Gray, who love her to
Yeah,
death, shout out
amazing.
right now. She's
Nice.
like, she's
Amazing.
one of the reasons I'm still here,
Oh, that's awesome.
helping to get from, you know, being stabilized to being to back to thriving, right? And that you don't flip a switch from being like on one end of the spectrum to the
Oh,
other.
God,
And
no.
even just getting from out of that treatment center to thriving was took years, right? But it took years and having enough self-awareness to say, this union thing's got to be put aside, right? All of these things have to be put aside because it's this, they're not helping, right? You got to focus on what you're doing, got to focus on yourselves, got to focus on your daughters. And you know, with a dissolution of a marriage, all of these things come with it, with selling a house and all, which are all stressors of themselves.
Course.
Got to get rid of all that stuff and then focus moving forward. So it took a long time, and you know, now it's at a point where, you know, I don't even recognize that person,
Really?
right? Like
Yeah.
that person there to this person now,
Night
like you
and
guys wouldn't even recognize, wouldn't even know who this guy is over here, not even the
Oh,
same,
crazy.
right? So in terms of managing that,
That's wild.
the thing, like in my own personal experience, you're
Yeah.
never cured from it.
Oh,
You
God,
never,
no.
but you
Yeah.
get to manage it, right? You can manage it. You get the tools given to you and you learn the strategies and you implement them in a manner to keep you to a point where if you feel yourself starting to go, you implement your strategies, you bring yourself down, and then you're good. But it's still like you're still dealing with the cumulative exposure to the calls that you're going to, whether you're on an ambulance or a police, a cruiser or a fire truck, you're still dealing with that until the point where
Every day.
you're done, right? When you retire. And then you still have to manage because a lot of the guys my dad's age, whether they'll admit it or not, like they're still dealing with
And you can
the issues.
tell.
You can tell,
Yeah.
100%. You know, you see somebody sitting at a kitchen table at work eating their lunch and they're sweating. Well, that's your central nervous system is
Yeah, beating you up.
beating you up,
Yeah,
right?
man.
So your physiological response is trying to tell you something that your psychological response is ignoring,
Yeah.
right? And we were fortunate enough, we did a project, a few of the people that I work with in this kind of this mental health sphere on developing technologies
Yeah.
to be able to have the physiological response through technology tell you
Yeah.
before your
Oh,
conscious
amazing.
comes in,
Yeah.
right? So
It
we
like
did some,
warns you of signs and stuff and oh, cool.
using heart rate variability and other factors.
Interesting.
Yeah,
That's
so it's kind of one of
awesome.
those things. And you know, there's a great team of people that I work with out west, Matty Johnson, Gus Mariquin, and all these guys
Yeah.
that are leaders in the field and clinical psychiatrists. And that's kind of where, in my opinion, things need to shift is because this is a stoic culture,
Absolutely.
right? Whether it's
Yeah.
police, fire, EMS, corrections, military, they're not telling you there's something wrong
No, God, no.
until there's no other option other than to say there's something wrong. But
Yeah.
they're whether it's stigma or whatever the issue is, they're not going to tell you
Right.
until it be till they're wrong. If they're saying there's something wrong, they've already redlined to the max, right? So
Yeah, true.
hopefully is to keep them into that green before or yellow before they even get to that red with strategies and tactics to be able to keep that down. But
Interesting.
it's tough. It's a tough
Yeah.
thing because well, you've been around enough firefighters to
Yeah.
know that like they're never going to tell you. They
Oh, God, no.
won't even tell you that they're hurt.
No.
They won't tell you that that cold plunge
No.
sucks, right?
Yeah.
Like
Yeah, they'll make jokes to get around it. And I'm like, bro, be honest. Like, this is
well,
miserable. I hate
that's
it.
yeah, dark humor in
Yeah.
emergency services
Required,
is
it
required,
feels.
right? So
Yeah.
yeah.
Oh, amazing. So I there's something topic of conversation I've been kind of working around with some friends of mine and stuff like that. And then yesterday on the show, then today I want to bring it up with you. So there's something I'm a big fan of actionables. right? And like tactics and things that you can use to, like, just as simple as it is, I have a problem, what's my solution, right? Like you said, it took years, right? Which length of time for solution, as long as we're working towards it, right? Awesome. But what I want to know is, where does empathy and understanding as a tool to help people get through their mental health struggles and at least put them in the right direction to have the habits that can manage it properly, right?
Right.
My thing is, so I'm not going to pretend to understand what you've been through to not, I don't want to disrespect you by pretending I, like, because I don't.
Right.
But I'm wondering, at what point is it on you to, okay, now, like, where's the tipping point of empathy and understanding? Like, we can sit there and I can, like, say, oh, like, man, like, I understand what you, I can, man, that's tough. It's bad. Like, all the sympathy, empathy, understanding for you in the world. But at what point is it okay for, like, now it's okay for me to say and for you to do, well, now I need to start plunging more. Now I need, or, you know, Ice Bath just brought it up, right? So it's like, yeah, when do I start making those strides? When do I start going to talk to these people? When do I start getting involved in those communities of people that are striving for the solution or working towards, like, where is it? Like, do they need that where, you know, you have two young girls at home?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
do they need that to dig to help them push forward? Or where, I'm trying to understand the, like, actionable versus the empathy and understanding. Like, when is it, okay, we've done as much understanding as we can, now we're past that point. And it's, I'm trying to understand that. Yeah,
and the, right? It's, and I think the reality is, it's, that's a personal decision, right, of the individual, right? Mm. And as it relates for, as it relates to the notion of someone else providing that empathy and sympathy and compassion, that's a double-edged sword, because compassion fatigue is a real thing.
100%.
Right? And if you're constantly, and this is a tactical error that lots of us do, is come home and you unload on your partner.
Yeah.
Or you come home and you don't ever unload on your partner. Right? And it builds and it builds. And a lot of the thinking, and this is, you know, having the lived experience of, my father worked in the fire service for 35 years. My mother worked in the police service for 30 years.
Epic.
Right. Those are two stoic individuals. Right. So yeah, they're not, like, my dad would, for the most part, wouldn't come home and tell my mom her story, his stories, because he doesn't want to dump that on her. And then, right, my mom doesn't want to dump it on us and on him. And it's just like,
they just hold on, just to
hold
it.
Hold on to, yeah, it. Right. Because at the time, that's what they're trained to do.
For sure.
Where I think the positive intermediary step is culturally competent and culturally aware clinicians, right?
Mm.
British Columbia, the firefighters in British Columbia, led by Matt and Gus and a good friend of mine, Gord Ditchburn and Steve Farina, they built a system where they would train mental health clinicians on what it meant to be a firefighter.
Whoa.
What that would look like, what that culture looks like.
That's
what,
huge.
So that they would understand. So you weren't just talking to somebody that knows that there's a red fire truck down the street.
They should have a PhD.
They know what it is to be a firefighter. So they created a whole network of culturally competent clinicians, right?
Whoa.
So that there, where at least if the men and women of these services are going to talk to a mental health clinician that actually knows what you're talking about,
man, that's fascinating.
It allows for that opportunity to get that out without that necessarily dumping it on.
There's less of a disconnect.
Correct. Right. Whoa. So, and they've been very successful in BC and Alberta and now in the eastern provinces,
nice,
at getting that out, right? And in terms of the men and women in the emergency services, they can go to a website and look up their city and look who's culturally competent.
Amazing.
Right? So they can go and pick the people that they know that they're going to be able to talk to about issues that are important to them, because they know that they've done this training. So I think that's a really good first step to try to minimize the, you know, the launch of information to your spouse or to your kids or to your friends or whatever, because, you know, everybody asks you, what's the worst thing you ever saw? you don't want to hear the worst thing I ever saw.
No, God, no.
You know what I mean? And it's like, you don't, and I know that you don't want to hear it.
Because I don't want you to have, like, I wish you wouldn't have seen that.
Right, exactly, right? Yeah. So it's kind of one of those things, right? So, yeah. So I think that's kind of the first step on it. But in terms of the personal responsibility to engage in the practices, like, that aren't maladaptive, right? Like, that aren't harmful, because that's the other thing. There's a lot of connection between occupational stress injuries and co-occurring addiction issues, right? Like, it's, for sure. Yeah,
100%.
Right?
And if used poorly.
Yeah, and that's the thing, right? Because at the end of the day, a lot of the mindset is like, I don't have freaking time to go see a psychiatrist right now or a psychologist right now.
50 things going on.
Just give me some benzos and I'll take it out. Like, give me some Klonopin or freaking whatever and I'll figure it out. And then that drives its own issues.
100%. Right?
So,
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's, I think, too, the main thing has been seeing, like, a surplus of men going through that issue. And like you said, less stoic individuals making it more of an issue and opting to play victim because they might not be in your situation where they're fortunate enough to have two. They're, you know, children that are like, there's something greater than me to live.
Yeah.
Right. So family and stuff like that. So looking at that and seeing kind of how, what men are doing and how men are kind of becoming, we talked a bit about this in the past, and stuff like that. And just seeing, like, even with like the movie, The Wolf, you recommended to me and stuff like that. Just seeing how it's becoming. And I like, do you follow Tim Kennedy? Like, do you know who he is?
No, I don't.
I'll send you one of it. It's, everything's extreme, but in like his personality is not what he's referring to and stuff like that. But yeah, you get a kick out of him. Big gun guy, like fighter, special ops, all that stuff. Right? Good fun stuff. But he has a thing called sheepdog. Like, his philosophy is like, there's three types of people, where there's wolves, which are like evil people.
Yeah.
There's sheep, which are like, you know, women, children that require protection.
Sure.
Of themselves, whatever. And then sheepdogs, which same DNA makeup as the wolf, but they like blood in the sheep.
American sniper. This is American
sniper. Exactly. Right? Yeah, exactly. So I find, though, a lot of what would be years ago, sheepdogs are now becoming sheep. Or like now requiring more protection from external sources. They're not able to protect for themselves, let alone protect for other people. So I'm curious, and I've asked people, a couple guests in the past, who I thought would be good to answer this, and I'd like to put you in that category and see. I'm going to change the question up a bit. So, because them, I had them answer three skills I think men should learn as early as possible to develop. It could be help them with the mental health aspect and just life in general, right? To be able to not unload on people and stuff like that and just live a positive, healthy life and all that fun stuff. So I would say three skills, but I want to do three hard skills and three soft skills, right? Okay. So three interpersonal skills and then three skills that are like, you know, change a tire or learn to fight, like stuff like that. So, you know, I'm curious to develop as early as possible, three soft and three hard skills that I think, curious.
I think in terms of the whole like psychological interpersonal thing, listening is the ability to listen and actively listen, I think is key, especially in today's world. And I'm guilty of, that's something I constantly work on. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But to sit in front of somebody, engage eye contact, and actually listen to what they're saying, I think is something that people really need to learn. As it relates to other ones, protective compassion, right? Like showing empathy, showing compassion while protecting yourself, not getting enmeshed is a huge thing for understanding what the other person's saying, but not letting their emotions flood onto you and to have that transfer on, I think is big, right? Like that's, and I see that a lot right now with like everything that's going on in the world is like, I'm going to dump all my stuff on you and
Problems are mine.
Right. And that's enmeshment. Right. And we're not, you know, that's more from a family side of things, but that's that concept. and saying no. Having the ability to say no,
Oh, it's tough.
unapologetically say no.
Not having to explain yourself. No, I can't today because of it.
Right? And
Yeah.
to this to the individual that you're talking about, that's, doing the fighting and the special ops and all this stuff, and the transition from sheepdog to sheep, be unapologetic about the sheepdog status. That is a blessing, and that is an honor, right? And it's one of those things, like, Ben Affleck in Boiler Room, act as if, right? Act as if you're the vice president of the goddamn company,
Hell yeah.
right? Don't be apologetic. And in today's world, the notion of, whatever they coin it on whatever particular day, like toxic masculinity or whatever, like, you have nothing to apologize for, right? It's embedded into your DNA. You're not societal change is not going to change this, like, hundreds of thousands of years one way and 50 years the other way. Don't apologize. Be the sheepdog. Be
Hell yeah.
respectful. Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. Open the door. Do all these things, but be vicious when you need to be.
Oh, hell yeah.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
Don't apologize for it. And I think that's
Let's
where
go.
people need to really understand, like, this whole cycle of weak men create hard times create hard
Good
men create good times,
times,
right? Like, and it's like, that's okay, man. Because at some point, I'll use my Twitter or X obsession as an example. We're seeing all of these protests and this and that, and all over North America. And then all of a sudden, one of the most iconic pictures coming out of 2024 is 20 frat boys holding up
I
the
love that.
American flag
Yeah.
at
Hell
UNC.
yeah. Yeah.
And what is the overwhelming response? Thank God
Yeah.
for these kids,
100%.
right?
Amazing.
They're not apologizing for it.
Oh no.
They're
God
not, and
no.
there's other issues that are surrounding it, but it's like
Yeah. The fact of the matter is,
they
yeah.
stood up for something that they believed in
Hell yeah.
unapologetically, right? And
Right.
it's like, there's
Yeah.
you can be yourself without having to cater to any or every special interest whim at any given time. Like,
Yeah.
be yourself unapologetically. Be yourself. Don't be an asshole.
Right.
Don't be a dick. But if somebody else thinks you're being a dick for being yourself, whatever, man. That's
Yeah.
your issue. That's not my issue. As
Yeah.
long as you're a good person, like,
Right, your intention's huge.
right? At the end of the day, you call somebody an asshole, you call somebody an asshole. If they're gonna get offended by that, well,
It's their problem.
whatever, man. You know what I
100%.
mean? And then hard skills, yeah, change the tire, 100%. Learn how to split wood. Like,
Fuck
I used to, I my old house, I
yeah. I
used to
love
have
it.
to freaking cut 40 cords of wood
Yeah.
every year. And it was like, when I
I
first moved
love it.
there, I'd be like, I feel like such a fucking idiot. I don't even know how to do this shit,
Yeah.
right? Learn how to do that and learn how to gut an animal.
That's on my list.
It's
It's on my list.
100%,
This and next year.
right?
Yeah,
Learn how to
we're
field
getting
dress
there.
a deer, learn how to field dress a moose,
We're
learn
getting
how to
there.
field dress a bear. Because at the end of the day, if you do not know how to do that, and the shit hits the fan, where are you at? Right? It's like the whole gun thing that we were talking about. You could not have any of these things and everything could be fine, but you could not have any of these things and things not be fine.
What's the saying, man? It's better to need it or have it and not need it than need it
That's
and
exactly
not
right.
have it,
Right?
right?
And it's cool. It's
Yeah.
cool.
It's fucking sick. It's fucking sick. Yeah, at the end of the day, oh my goodness, man. Oh, it's awesome. As one of like a last question to kind of round things out before we conclude. I saw this guy in this podcast I follow about like real estate investing, very random,
Okay.
but he does this thing and I want to kind of adopt it. But he does three books, two people, one quote. I'm gonna change that last one to like one lesson you've learned, whatever that, or piece of advice that might be, worthwhile to somebody like, you when you were in your late
Right,
teens or
right,
20s.
right.
Do you so three books, two people, one quote lesson.
So three books. First one would be Victory Lab by Sasha Eisenberg. The second one would be Trainspotting by Irvine Welsh. And the third one would be Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins,
Nice. Let's
right?
go.
two people, I would say Dr. Lori Gray,
Nice.
my psychologist, and Dr. Abby Morris, my clinical psychiatrist down in Maryland.
Amazing.
And one quote would be, to be yourself in a world that's constantly trying to change you is its greatest accomplishment, by Ralph Waldo Emerson, right?
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Jeez. Every time I hear David Goggins, and I want to mention this to you, I think you'll love this. Such an as you like use them as one of your books. I was training for my marathon, right? And I have a buddy who's like diehard David Goggins fan,
Yeah.
at least at the time. And he's like pre-ordered his books before like David even mentioned he was having another. Anyways, he I post on my Instagram story like it was like minus 20 and we ran like 15K. Awesome, right? And I was like, yo, like David Goggins would be proud of you, bro. Like just like, hey man, like pat on the back. And like to him, Goggins replied to my story
With
and goes,
zero follower, or
this
was he follows zero people in the entire
zero
world.
people. He replied and goes, stay hard, boys. And
Nice.
I was like, yeah, let's go. I sent that to like seven people who are all like diehard Goggins fans, and I was like, guys, you'll get a kick out of this. Cause I wasn't one of those followers at the time. So I was like, this is hilarious. So
Yeah,
I was like
I was
grateful
never
for it.
really too much into his stuff until his Can't Hurt Me book.
Yeah.
Like, it was, and just to hear the humans, because I read it and then I listened to the podcast, and the podcast, or sorry, the audiobook, which is actually a podcast, he's being interviewed at the same time.
Oh,
And to
wild.
hear that, especially his early days with his mom and his dad, and the roller rink, and all that stuff, like, there's a human side to that, right? And yeah, some of it's extreme, but again, he's unapologetically being himself, right? And I think if more people were like that in the world, like, there'd be it would be a different place than it is right now. You know, there's too much of this issue. And then I'm going to move on to this, like the serial protesters that are constantly going from one hot button issue to the next, or on both sides, right? And it's just like, you know, it's just freaking be yourself in this world, and at the end of the day, try to be a good person as much as you can. And, you know, like, and Goggins is a prime example. As
100%.
hardcore as he is, and
Right.
as rough as he is, and, you
Yeah.
know, kind of gruff around the edges or whatever, but just doing
Yeah.
his thing, right?
We need it. We need more of it. And yeah, couldn't agree
I
more.
wouldn't want a whole world of David Goggins, can you imagine?
That'd be tough. Every day would be, whew. Man, I'd be hurt. I know nothing can hurt me, but
Oh yeah.
yeah, I'd be hurt.
No,
I'd be
it'd be
hurting.
too much. Too many Trevor Albinars doing
Yeah.
drill plunges all over this world. You never
Bruh.
freaking get out
Man,
of
every time I'm like, I don't know, man. I don't know how he does it. But well, that's awesome. Shout
Well,
to him for
yeah.
sure. But
And you know what the thing is,
that's
Glenn?
awesome.
Like,
That's
it's
awesome.
one of these things that, like, you guys, when I met you guys for the first time, it was before you even knew that I met you. Like, when you guys started
What?
the 5 Cent City, when I went and spoke at it. And then when we started doing the cold plunges,
Yeah,
and it's
that's where I
like,
first met you,
yeah. But it's like, you see, your group of friends, like you, Zach, Patty, Christian, all these guys, like, 5 Cent City is a prime example, man.
hundred
You see
percent.
a problem, we're gonna fix it.
Hell yeah.
And we're gonna be unapologetic about it, right? And like Mike and everybody, and it's just like, it's
Love
like
everyone.
so many people are talking about changing the world, and then this group of friends in Sudbury, Ontario, says, "No,
Let's
we're gonna
do
fucking change the world." And it's
We're
like,
gonna do that.
we're gonna do that, and we're not gonna alter our principles. We're not gonna do anything other than what we want to do and what's
Hundred
fun,
percent.
and raise awareness. And you know, that 5 Cent City was one, like, to this day is still one of the coolest things I've ever
That's
seen. So
awesome.
kudos to you guys, man, because it's
Appreciate
wild,
that.
man. It's for sure.
I'm so grateful for that opportunity. Have been I wouldn't have met you because of it. I wouldn't have, like, man, I just meet it like doing the show. It's like steamrolled into that, like meeting Pat to meeting Zach to meeting to going to 5 Cent City to meeting Michael to like now going there a second year and being kind of a bit more involved, and then the third year last year, and then being like meeting Trevor through Pat and meet like all these guys, and I'm like, what? Like
Yeah.
it's crazy to me to look at and to see where like the potential of what there is to become is like even just getting glimpses of it and like hearing from what you guys have gone through and being able to learn from you guys as a byproduct of doing that and kind of in my mind being unapologetically myself.
Yeah.
And understanding what people are going through and trying my absolute best to learn from guys like you and stuff like you've been through just to help me, and being grateful that you're able to take the time to even just give me the time of day to sit down on your day off and tell me about things you've gone through and helped me get a greater understanding of things that I'm interested in.
Right on.
So
right
on. I'm super grateful for this conversation, the ones we've had in the past and the ones we'll have in the future. So
absolutely, man. Right, thank you again for having me here. It's been great.
Yeah, man. Yeah, appreciate it. Yeah,
beautiful.
Where can people connect with you? Where can people find you? Which is the preferred way to reach out and stuff?
I've been actually trying to get off social media as much as possible, but you can always find me on Instagram or Twitter or whatever. I've been trying to remove myself from that a little bit, but for the most part, yeah, people can find me wherever. They can go to the local fire hall and try to find me there for the most.
Knock on the door.
Yeah.